Do you know when you're in the pub and an old football match comes on, a rocket of a shot hits the bar and bounces out? And then somebody says, do you ever wonder what would have happened if that had gone in? Imagine if we'd scored that. What if we'd won that game?
Then everyone has an opinion. Well, the manager would probably have kept his job. We could have gone in to win the league that year. Ah, we still would have messed it up. We were shite anyway. Such fine margins that could have potentially massive consequences.
In this series, we look at some of the biggest what-ifs in football history. What happened? What could easily have played out very differently? And what we think might have happened instead? This is Outside the Box.
The 1988 UEFA European Championship Final.
And here's Robins. And did it get the deflection? Was it Robins or Pierce?
Attention. Attention, Kostadinov.
What?
Yes. No. No, the linesman says no. The linesman says no.
I think they should really stop flogging a dead horse, basically. It's over. It's finished.
It was in the year of 88 in the lovely month of June when the gadflies were swarming and dogs howling at the moon.
This week, what if Vim Keeft hadn't scored against Ireland at Euro 88?
How it rose, repeats and sandwiches for Stuttgart we began. Jocks are packed as German phrase book and jump leads for the van.
Welcome to another episode of Outside the Box, a What If Football podcast. I'm Gerard O'Shea, and joining me remotely again this week is Dave Fleming.
Hello, Ger. Good to be here again. Thank you very much. Yeah, still doing these remotely. Another day, the same lockdown, but here we are doing another podcast.
And having a look at another footballing What If.
Today, we're talking about Saturday, 18th of June, 1988. So the Republic of Ireland are playing the Netherlands in their last group game of the European Championships. Ireland won their first game against England and drew their second game against the Soviet Union. So a draw here would see Ireland qualify for the semi-finals of their first ever international tournament. But the Dutch were beaten by the Soviets in their first game. They beat England in the second game. So they have to win to go through. The stakes are unbelievably high.
After a tight, close game in which Ireland probably had the best chance, 8 minutes from the end, Dutch substitute Wim Kieft gets his head on a mishit shot from Ronald Koeman. The ball heads initially well wide of the goal, but due to the spin on the ball, turns wickedly when it bounces, just around Irish keeper Paddy Bonner and into the bottom corner. It's a goal that has been described as freakish, bizarre and skittery, and it's easy to imagine it doesn't go in. A centimetre left and perhaps Bonner reaches it. A centimetre the other way, perhaps it hits the post.
Let's not forget the fact that technically the goal should have actually been disallowed for offside.
Absolutely. It wouldn't be offside now, but as the rules stood in 1988, Van Basten was totally offside. But Keith's header does go in, and the Dutch scrape through to the semi-finals ahead of Ireland.
Ireland go home to a moderate hero's welcome, a brave moral victory in their first ever international finals appearance. The Dutch beat West Germany in the semi-final, and they go on to win their first ever, and actually to date, only major tournament. Spectacular volley from Marco Van Basten in the final against the Soviet Union again.
But what if, on that fateful day in June 1988, Kieft's header doesn't go in and Ireland go through instead of Holland?
So we're going to be looking a bit later at kind of potential implications for some of the other actors in this scenario, the Dutch, the Germans, the Soviet Union, as well as maybe what it might have meant for football in general if it had happened. But first, we're going to look at who would have been the immediate beneficiaries, and that is Ireland. If the ball doesn't go in, Ireland qualify for the semi-finals of Euro 88. And joining us to discuss this tantalising possibility, I'm very excited to say, one of Ireland's most prominent novelists, poets and playwrights. His play In High Germany, set at this tournament, one of the finest examples of football in theatre and a really seminal work in defining just what this tournament actually meant for Ireland and for so many people at the time. I'm very happy to welcome Mr. Dermot Bulger. Dermot, hello.
Hello, Dave, and hello, Jude.
How are you?
I'm grand. I'm better than I was in Gelsenkirchen in 1988, I tell you that much.
Dermot, we're going to have a lot of questions for you, and we're going to talk because you've got so many stories. You were at most of this tournament, as well as most of the qualifiers. But before we get into the football side of things, I kind of just want to ask you, yourself and Jar are a little younger than yourself. We would have been kids in 1988, but maybe you might give us a bit more context. What was Ireland like in 1988 when we qualified for this tournament? The country as a whole?
The country as a whole was a tad shambolic in many ways, and Irish football was it was summed up in the closest I ever came to being killed was when Ireland played the then world champions Italy in Dalymount Park a couple of years before we qualified for this. And of course, they didn't actually bother printing tickets, and they took cash at the turnstiles, and they only had around three turnstiles open. And a massive crush ensued when an ambulance came down Connaught Street in Fitzroy, and everybody pushed up, let the ambulance through. And I remember lying on top of a girl who was lying on top of somebody else. And I thought it was another pile of bodies, but we were lying on one of these things that had turned over, one of these crowd control barriers. And I say I came within 3 to 4 minutes of dying when the police opened the actual the exit gates, and I was pulled into the ground by a policeman by my foot. And I sat shivering on the ground for 10 minutes, and I went out and I retrieved my shoe from a load of other shoes lying in that then deserted thing. And the world champions played with around 400 or 500 people sitting on the turf around the actual edge of the ground, and the world champions having to step over various bodies whenever they wanted to take a free kick or a throw in. And that sort of level of shambolic organisation was pretty endemic of the country at the time.
It's certainly a stark metaphor for kind of wider society in terms of, like, unemployment obviously was a pretty low ebb. Tax rates, interest rates, and society as a whole, as well as the football team, were, you know, again, Dave has said we're a bit younger, but there probably wasn't a brilliant place to be.
It probably wasn't, and like there was certainly no sense in 1988 that Ireland was going to be plunged into euphoria by doing well in Euro 88, and in fact, there was very little sense in the build-up to your 88, until we actually qualified by accident in October of 77, that we were going to qualify, because we actually had a very mediocre campaign. The last match of that campaign, we actually played our best match. We played against Bulgaria, and we actually bet them 2-0. McGrath and Moran scored goals from the back. And Liam Brady, who was a magnificent player at the time, got sent off. I remember the crowd, including myself, was there, giving Brady a wonderful ovation going on, because he'd actually walked his socks off for Ireland, not only in that match, but the whole campaign. And we also knew that it didn't matter that he was sent off, because there wasn't a snowball's chance in hell of Ireland getting to Euro 88, because Bulgaria were going to get there, because one of the worst teams in the group were Scotland. And Scotland would have to beat Belgium, and they'd have to beat Bulgaria for us to get through. And that was never, ever going to happen. And so I remember it was all like, you know, applauding Brady off the field, because that suspension would only count for the European championships, and in 4 years' time he'd be retired. And so literally 6 minutes before Ireland qualified for this tournament, there was no sense in Ireland that we were going to qualify for this tournament.
Was the team well supported in those days?
It was better supported than Athlone Town or Longford Town, and probably better now than Cavintilly United are. But there was a core of support for the team. And I had been to, I was a young broke poet and a young broke publisher, and we had loads of unsold poetry books. And myself and George, who was my assistant, devised this mad scheme where we persuaded Willie John McBride to give us £1,000 to give poetry books to all of the schools in Dublin, these unsold Raven poetry books. And we used this money to go and see Ireland play Denmark on their own hand in Copenhagen, where we were absolutely slaughtered. And the team came out with their heads down, and sort of we were beaten, I think, 3-0 in the end. And what was fascinating about that was that at least half the Irish crowd in Copenhagen had come from outside Ireland. They'd come, loads had come from England, loads had come from Germany. There were either spare ticket, and there were three lads with thick Kerry accents. You couldn't understand the word they were saying almost. And I said, "How'd you get here?" And they were looking for a ticket. And I said, "Hey, take mine. I take this one. I have a spare one." And they said, "How much?" I said, "No." I said, "Just take it. Go on, it's present." And I said, "How'd you get here?" I said, "We got here by bus." And I said, "The bus from Tralee." He said, no, the bus from Cologne, and there were all these factory workers. It was a time of high emigration. So it was that thing that was reflected in the makeup of the team in Euro 88 and also in the crowd who were there in Euro 88, that Ireland, the word diaspora had not been invented at the time. I hadn't entered the Irish lexicon. But like, I'm from a family, my mother was from a family of 11 on a small farm in Monaghan. My father from a family of 7 in Wexford. And they all emigrated, with the exception of the uncle who got the farm, the uncle who got the house in Wexford, and my father, who was a sailor, who emigrated for 44 years twice a week. And the only reason that I have an Irish accent is because my father was able to emigrate and work on different ships and send money home. And so, you know, that team that went out in Gelsenkirchen and went out in Hanover and went out in Stuttgart, that, you know, that menagerie of accents represented my family history. They represented all of my uncles, aunts, and all of my cousins were written out of Irish history. And they also represented a large proportion of the people who followed the Irish team. Because when the Irish team, the crowds weren't huge for those games, but when the Irish team went abroad, at least half the supporters who followed them were first generation, second generation Irish. So that trip to Copenhagen was a real eye-opener.
It's something we probably come to later on, I suppose, in terms of the consequences of it. But it's something that we were chatting about as well, about how that team, and you've said it really well there, about how that team really embraced the diaspora. And it spoke to, and like it as you, in High Germany, obviously, is a play that talks about that and looks at that. But how, and I wonder, again, having come to this kind of, as an adult much later, this ability of this team to accept, embrace, and capitalize on, you know, and represent not just those living in Ireland, but those who'd left in the 50s and their children. And that was something I think we embraced in the 90s and becomes part of the social change that happens after that, that we finally had an Ireland that represented not only those of us who were here, but those of us who'd had to leave as well.
Well, but this is about the characters. See, I won't talk much about High Germany, but it's about three lads. I wanted to make them like miserable existentialists. So I made them Bose fans, so they would have a life of prolonged misery before the game even began, you know? And their ambition has always been to go abroad and see Ireland play in a major tournament and to come home as heroes with stories to tell. And as the play unfolds, we realize that actually none of them are going home to Ireland. One of them is going to America on the black. One of them works in Eindhoven. And the other lad, the narrator, is actually living in Hamburg, which is one of the places where we would have got to if that bloody goal hadn't gone in. It was one of the semi-final places. And in some ways, they recognize that the only island that they actually belong to, representation of Ireland that they can feel that they still belong to, is this football team, is this menagerie of accents of people who were, I tell you, and there was very little distinction between those born in Ireland and those born outside Ireland. I mean, like somebody who was born outside Ireland who couldn't bear to watch that tournament because he had the quality to be there was Dave O'Leary. Mm. I mean, Dave O'Leary was actually born in London. And he was able to come home, unlike his parents were able to come home when he was quite young. You know, somebody born, somebody whose mother was born in Limerick and who never came home was Chris Hughton's mother. You know, so you actually had that strange mixture. And I think there was one of the great things about that team was that nowadays you have people, you know, will they declare for Ireland? Won't they declare for Ireland? You have managers involved, you have agents involved, everything else. It was very much, it was a bit like the Magnificent Seven without the music. You know, I mean, Jack Charlton went down to Oxford to get Ray Houghton and wound up getting John Aldridge as well. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was very, very casual, sort of people wanted to commit. It wasn't about career moves. It wasn't about sort of making money and endorsements. It was actually just, it was a group of people who came together. And I have a feeling that some of them didn't feel that Irish before. They began the adventure, but it felt very, very Irish. In fact, you could generally, you know, when you, Townsend isn't playing here, but like he's playing a couple of years later, and he's talking about like stuffing the English and everything else, and with venom in his voice. You know? So actually, they were sort of rather like, generally the best Irish patriots are born in England, actually, you know.
Well, let's get back to the football for a minute now. We'll have a little look at. Dermot, you were talking there about kind of how Ireland almost qualified accidentally and they didn't play much brilliant football in the qualifiers. But You said this when I first approached you about being on this podcast, and myself and Gerard have talked about this loads, but there was only eight teams in the tournament in Euro 88. Only eight. That's mental. So the host West Germany, and then seven teams qualify. Seven. I think these days about 57 teams get to the Euros there or thereabouts. What's the actual number? There's 24, isn't it, actually going to the next Euros? Ireland still don't qualify.
I think if you have more than six drink driving points, you now qualify for the Euros, you know? What I loved about that, I remember the tournament before this in 84. It was the most brilliant tournament to watch because every match was... vital. Every match was important, and they all happened really quickly. I think the Ireland games happened within 6 days of each other. They were, it was all. And while the other games were happening that same week, and then you had the next week, you had the actual. So within a fortnight, the whole thing was over. Also, there was far less countries in Europe. So I mean, when you're saying you're playing the USSR, which we played in Hanover, and Ronnie Whelan scored an extraordinary goal. I mean, you're playing. You know, Russia, Georgia, Estonia, Latvia, this massive.
There's 14 of them now, I think.
Yeah, but it was some achievement to get there. You mentioned Euro 84. France won Euro 84. They finished third in the world in 86. They didn't qualify for 88. We look at some of the teams who didn't get there. Like Yugoslavia were brilliant then. Belgium had done brilliantly in the World Cup as well in 86. Portugal didn't qualify. Romania, Sweden, Czechoslovakia. Like, you could have made a pretty good tournament out of the teams that didn't qualify, never mind the teams that were there.
The whole success of Irish soccer at the time was based on the fact that you actually got 2 points for a win and 1 point for a draw. I mean, once we moved to 3 points for a win, we'd have been screwed in a lot of these tournaments because we actually just squeaked through by winning loads of games 1-1.
Yeah, I was just going to make that same joke there, but you bet me to it. Yeah, we bet them 1-1.
So we get through, ultimately, you know, there's a famous single goal in a single game. Scotland beat Bulgaria. How was that? I mean, how was that game received? Was it well watched in Ireland? I know, I think it was covered on TV, which would have been a bold choice.
It was on TV. I ran Ravenland's Press from a little house in Nen Street in Fisborough, and there's a pub across the road called Cross Guns Pub.
Jury up and battling. And he did well to get away there. Oh, look at that. That was always on. But advantage is played. Good refereeing. And it's come through now to Mackay. And it's there! It's there! Gary Mackay, the substitute, has put Scotland in the lead. And Ireland is surely on their way to Germany.
And I remember this total silence descending. It was a really pretty silent bar on the Cross Guns pub. And everybody's looking at each other. And then the screaming broke out, and we had suddenly like 6 minutes to go, and we were going to be, for the first time ever, all those efforts by own hand and by people beforehand, and even going back to, you know, Ireland playing Spain, the playoff, when Eamon Dunphy made his debut for Ireland, going back in prehistory. Suddenly, we were being handed this gift if the Scots could hold on for 6 minutes. There was this sort of, almost like a strange mist came over the city. And suddenly, you know, old men who hadn't left their armchairs in 45 years were out on the street shouting and screaming. And I went up that night in the Hill pub in Ranelagh. And people were just, it was like everybody had won the lottery without even knowing that they'd bought a ticket. And I remember like Barman coming out and saying, like, time now, lads, time. And him being carried shoulder high by the patrons around the bar saying, time, time, time. And it was just, what was, because if you think when Ireland qualified for the World Cups and for the later European Championships, there was all this sort of hype going on for months beforehand and newspapers producing specials and everything else. Literally, nobody gave Ireland a chance of qualifying for this game, 6 minutes before we qualified. And that made us incredibly joyous because literally there was no hype, there was no promotions, there was nobody selling anything. It was just sheer euphoria. And then we just presumed that we were going to get our asses kicked in Germany.
Ireland, Ireland, we can celebrate. Ireland, Ireland, in Euro 88.
I love that idea. The barman being lifted around the pub is just brilliant. But we get there. You've said it, Dermot, and Jared touched on it as well. Just to make it abundantly clear that eight teams qualified, it basically means that in the group stages, we had to play three of the best teams in the world inside a week. Yeah. I think, yeah, it was 6 days, I think, between the three games. That was the two groups. So Ireland are drawn in a group against the Soviet Union, the Netherlands, and England.
And ironically, we are probably in the weaker of the two groups.
Yeah, because the other group has West Germany, who would obviously had been beaten in the final, I think, of the previous two World Cups and would go on to win the next one. Italy, who had you'd seen them as world champions, they'd won that only 6 years before. Spain, I think, were runners-up the last time. They're always there. Denmark had obviously been brilliant in 86 and dispatched Owen Hand as well. So, like, that other group is unbelievably good.
But there wasn't really a week. You know, we only have eight teams. You don't really have a week. You're one slightly weaker than the other. But like, the USSR and... Holland should have been enough. And England had a disaster tournament and actually didn't get a single point in the whole thing. But it was actually, by the time we get to Gelsenkirchen, it's much the same 11 that began, played in all those games. In that match in Gelsenkirchen, you could just see the sheer exhaustion of the Irish players. Because they'd never played at this level in a tournament, and they'd never, and I'm sure as professionals, they had played three games in a row in 6 days, but at that level of intensity, and the heat in Gelsenkirchen was absolutely unbelievable. It was almost impossible to breathe in the ground. They played in midday in really, really torrential heat, and you just see them, they were wilting before our eyes and giving everything they actually had. And the crowd were the same. The crowd were, the crowd were on this really strange adventure that nobody, because with 7 minutes to go on that match, right, we actually didn't know where we were going. If we held on for a nil-all draw, we were going to Hamburg. Now, I actually had come from Hamburg because I had a sister-in-law who was married to an Indian chap in Hamburg, and the Indian chap was a lovely guy, but he was quite sort of, he would like things to be in done in a certain way and a bit regimented and quite elderly. And he didn't know that there were going to be eight Irish soccer fans sleeping on the floor that night if Ireland actually won. And then if we if Ireland drew, then if we won, we were going to go to Munich for the other semi-final. And if we lost, we didn't know where we were going. Gelsenkirchen is a small city and Essen is the nearest big city. And we went back to Essen after the game. We were all actually emotionally shell-shocked. And you actually had this extraordinary thing because the Germans are quite, you know, practical and everything else. And you had a queue of Irish fans of all ages at the ticket, at ticket counter. And they're just saying, can I have a ticket, please? And the person was saying, where do you want to go? He says, I don't give a fuck. Just give me a ticket. And because literally they didn't actually know where they were going, or they didn't know. And so you actually had this. I remember there was a German guy sitting there, and he called us off. I was with six guys. He called us off and he bought six beers. And he said, because the goal was offside. and he was talking about he didn't spend hours there. And there was great respect. What I noticed about when I got on the train to go to Hamburg and I was wearing the Irish scarf and everything else, suddenly there was great respect in the ticket collector and there was great respect in sort of everybody there. And, you know, Ireland had arrived internationally in a sporting sense in that week. So you had this extraordinary transformation in 1 week.
Well, yeah. Well, Jared, do you want to talk us through kind of what had actually happened with Ireland in the tournament up to this point?
Yeah, so I mean, we play England first. Of course we do. We get drawn against England and Charlton, who, you know, in my mind, Charlton had won the World Cup with England in another lifetime. But in 1988, it was only 22 years ago. So it was a very recent memory. We play England. I believe that's the game you're not at, Dermot.
Bizarrely, I had to attend the book launch in Dublin as a publisher. But also, I remember that game because, again, going back to Leinster Street, my old neighbour, I watched it in a house in Finsborough. And just the excitement in Dublin that day. Again, nobody expected Ireland. Nobody really gave Ireland a chance. They were almost afraid to hope. I remember like walking back to Leinster Street and Harry Sheridan was his name. He was an old man. He was in his late 80s. And he stood at his gate. And he just said to me, I don't think this guy ever had an interest in soccer in his life. And he just said to me, I can die happy.
Watch
and so yeah, and then the next day I went, and we had a notion that we would book into a youth hostel, because you know who would book into a youth hostel. And of course, when I arrived in Hanover, I discovered that around 9,000 people had booked into the youth hostel in Hanover. Most of them people in their 80s and of every age. And so then there was that game against the USSR. We actually won a game that we should have lost, because the English should have really have won. That we actually drew a game we should have won, because we were all over the USSR, and we were a much better team, and we actually lost a game that we should have drawn, because we had matched the Dutch until that offside goal.
Yeah. So I suppose that brings us to the game in Gelsenkirchen. Obviously much closer for geographically for the Dutch than the Irish. Presumably they're there in bigger numbers. What's the atmosphere like in the half an hour leading up to the game, in the hour leading up to the game? Because at this point, whatever, we're lucky to be there. We didn't think we'd qualify. We're now on the cusp of potentially qualifying. Has that position in terms of the optimism around Ireland changed?
Yeah, I mean, we were very optimistic until we approached the ground and discovered that there was, I don't know what, if it holds 50,000, or held 50,000, there was like 45 Dutch there, and 42,500 of those were skinheads. It was actually sort of a really quite, and it was what was bizarre now with health and safety is that, well, firstly, we from Gelsenkirchen, we had to get these small little trams out. And I had the misfortune, myself and my friends, to be stuck on a tram with around 60 Dutch skinheads who's all shaven heads and all eyes as hard as the walls of Limerick Jail. And they were sort of just glaring at us. And it was a really, really tense situation. And so we did what all Irish people abroad in all times of stress and uncertainty do. We put our hands in our ear and we sang, "If you hate the Queen of England, clap your hands." And all the Dutch joined in and thought this was a wonderful thing. And so this kept us all engaged, and it kept us from being killed on the actual tram. And then when we got to the ground, I always remember there was an incredibly long way in from the gates. You had to walk up this like pathway, and it was just covered in loose stones. And I said, if we lose this game, they're going to kill us. We're going to be stoned to death on the way in. And then you went in, and it was very, very hostile, very, very, you were surrounded on three sides by this massive wall of orange shorts. And it was a very, very hostile episode. And then, of course, the Dutch were these, you know, you had Hullet, and you had these, there were like huge sort of players coming out as well. So it was from the world go, you just said, please God, let us get through this 90 minutes. And then please God, somehow let us find a way to get out of this ground without being killed. Because you literally, it was a ground where, I mean, there was like a singular absence of Matt Stewart or anybody else. There was just like this couple hundred yards of unpaved, of loose stones that we had to like get out if we won the match. So it was actually sort of, I think for the players and for the fans, it was a little bit of a hostile environment.
Okay. I've watched, I mean, it's a long time since I've seen the full game through. I was watching some of the highlights again recently, prepared for this. The Paul McGrath header, I've watched almost daily. I still kind of don't understand how it doesn't go in between the header itself and I think it's Aldridge at the rebound. I almost don't understand the physics of it, how it doesn't go in.
Yeah. I remember being there, and again, you were just convinced it was going to go in. I remember like 2 minutes before this goal, an old guy beside me just literally sat down and said, "I can't take any more, lads. Tell us the result." And just said that, and I actually felt he was going to have a heart attack. Like, we weren't used to this. Like, we were used to like winning the Eurovision, and sort of, you know, seeing the odd horse win in Cheltenham. Like, we nothing in our DNA had actually prepared us for the just the sheer anxiety and excitement of that. And you know, you're hoping against hope. You're hoping against hope. And then the goal goes in. And it was such a weird, bizarre, in the same way as you can't figure out how the McGrath header didn't go in, I still can't figure out how the Dutch goal actually went in. And the actual linesman put his flag up for offside.
Did he?
And then took it down again.
Ah, Jesus. So now I'm upset all over again.
How had Ireland played in the game?
I'm still getting over the trauma myself, you know.
How had Ireland played, actually, in the game?
How did Ireland play? We played well, but as the game went on, you could see them literally hanging on. Like Frank Stapleton was suddenly looked like a very, very old man. And he was, and there wasn't a hint of wind. And Frank Stapleton needed wind because actually, if you saw him play in the qualifying games in Lansdowne Road, he would get the ball, he would stand with his backside to the defender facing the crowd and wait for the first puff of wind and fall over and get a free kick. And there was no wind in Gelsenkirchen, he couldn't do this. And you could just see the players just getting exhausted. So it was fairly even first half, but then actually as the game went on, it was just to do with the level of physical fitness and the level of heat and the level of exhaustion. But I actually had felt it had got to a point where you said, no, we're actually going to do this. My main worry with 6 minutes to go was how I was going to explain the presence of eight people to my Indian brother-in-law in Hamburg.
And then the goal goes in.
Yeah, what was the reaction like in the stand, Dermot?
There was silence. There was just, you know, people were mostly drained before the goal went in, and I think we all knew that we weren't going to equalise. Do you know what I mean? Like the team just didn't have it in it, and there was maybe 90 seconds of silence, and then just this massive chant of Ireland, Ireland, and, you know, and the full of boys in green and all that sort of stuff. And the crowd just totally got behind that team. And so there was just a cacophony of noise. And so even though we knew it was a hopeless case, it caused in many ways, we just, you know, gave everything that we had for the players on the pitch. And the Dutch didn't really celebrate too much when they won. I remember as they filed away in silence, the Irish crowd stayed there chanting, sing when you're losing, you only sing when you're losing. And we, I think, stayed for 20 minutes afterwards and demanded that Jack Charlton come back out and everything else. And I mean, Charlton just being a bit bewildered by the fact that we'd actually lost the match and that the crowd were still... So the Irish crowd was still totally supportive. I think that was the day that he really won. When obviously, the victory against England like ignited that thing, but just the actual effort against the Dutch and the fact that they ran themselves into the ground, I think really formed a great bond with those fans, which spilled over into the next qualifying campaign and the one after as well.
But that's a very interesting point that I kind of think we might touch on where I think we're going to move on now. The point of the podcast is what if? So it's what if the goal doesn't go in, we hold on, we get a draw, and we qualify for the semifinals instead of the Dutch. If we get a draw, we would have played West Germany in the semifinal. I suppose the first question, Dermot, is do you think we would have had any hope of beating them?
I actually don't think so, to be honest with you. Like, you think now about squad rotation. And I mean, the amount of subs, I think there are only like maybe three subs, four subs on the bench. Nowadays, you have like, you have 11 subs on the bench, and you have, I mean, in this current thing, you actually have three subs allowed. We were coming off a very small gene pool. Yeah. In the sense of you actually had, I mean, you had good players on the bench. You had Kevin Sheedy popping in, popping off. You had Niall Quinn there. You had people like John Anderson, John Bourne, and Jerry Payton. And, you know, there weren't, David Kelly, I think, was there. So I just think that team in Gelsenkirchen was so... Now, maybe I can't remember the chronology of when... the how many days rest there would have been. But they,
it was another three or something.
We shouldn't have beaten England, and we did. So certainly we would have been, we would have actually already won the lottery, and that can give players a great lift. And then there would have been pressure because the Germans would have been expected to win. Yeah. But the Germans are, and I love German people and everything else, but as footballers, they are fairly ruthless bastards. And so the actual sort of, so I think the only thing that was getting through to the final, to the semi-final against Germany would have done is that it probably would have helped to improve Dutch-German relations, because I seem to remember was it Koeman wiped his ass with the German jersey after the match, which so that's sort of, we might have improved international relations, but again, with a 90-minute match, you never know. If we had just been able to recover and maybe we had a bit more depth, we could have gone on, you know? But again, these things are the realms of speculation.
Yeah, I think as well, you said about how the team were out on their feet, and I think particularly the way Ireland played then, which was pretty much unlike anyone else, it was very attritional, it was very high energy. Yeah. And I think Ronnie Whelan subsequently said how basically after three games in a week, coupled with celebrating and partying after them, they were out on their feet. Now, I think I agree with you. We probably would have got beaten 1-2 and it'd be a narrow defeat. I also think there's a little element where if I was an ex-pro in Ronnie Whelan's situation and had come that close, it's probably how I'd comfort myself years later and go, we wouldn't have won anyway. But you never know. Something could have happened. But I think I agree with you. We'd have gone down bravely a round later.
But this is kind of what you were saying there, very interesting about the amazing bond between Charlton and the fans that has been formed here now, and the fans had stayed out and insisted, you know, he comes out and says goodbye because they died on their shields, like, you know, they didn't give in. It was a late freak goal that sent them out, but it would have not been a massive surprise on the balance of play if they'd gotten the draw. But what if they did go get the draw? They go to the semi-final against West Germany. They're absolutely bollocksed and Germany battered them like 3-0.
You had that. I mean, like, gone to more recent times. I mean, I think Martin Neil was doing okay until he came a cropper against the Danes. Was it 5-1? I remember watching in a hotel in Portugal, and I use language that the Portuguese aren't used to, and that was the end of things. So in some ways, we actually did go out, and with, you know, with that wonderful historical sense of injustice, which has sustained the Irish nation for generations and centuries, that we actually sort of we were sent to Van Diemen's Land for a crime we didn't commit. So there is a danger that the whoever we met in the next round might have stuffed us. But if we had got to the final and if we had played the USSR, I actually would have fancied our chances, because I felt that in Hanover, that was our best game and we were a perfect match for the USSR. Now, they probably had a stronger squad, but I'm not sure that managers rotated players quite as much then as they do now.
No, also the squads were only 20 as well, compared to the squads now, and even at the major championships are 23. They're only 20 man squads then, so even the opportunity to rotate wouldn't have been as big. But
I expect that the crowd would have been very much, if we got the final against the USSR, I think that the crowd would have been very much on the Irish side.
Doesn't bear thinking about us winning it nearly sometimes, doesn't it?
No. Well, actually, I think in some ways it would have been, if we had actually got to the semi-final of that, then almost like getting to the quarterfinals of the World Cup would almost have been an anticlimax. So there was, like, Leopold Bloom said that the revolution must come on the Joe Stallman's plan. And so just beating England and not being disgraced and being, you know, drawing with the USSR and essentially drawing into the last couple of minutes with the Dutch, we came home with enormous pride. And I think that Charlton built on that in the next World Cup, and we did great. And I think that the one that got away was the next European Championships, which probably when we had our best team
and soft tournament
imploded. And I think we wound up like 3-1 up in Poland, and sort of Paki Bonner started doing, standing on his head or something. I remember there was just like, that was one that got away. And then, and we actually thought we'd qualified and we didn't. And again, England won that group again. And that's, I think, you know, if there was a European Championships that we could have won, I think it was probably the one 4 years later that we weren't actually in, which is one of the strange ironies.
Yeah. So imagine a scenario here where we get to the semi-final and then Italia 90 largely plays out the same as it did, that it, you know, it hasn't massively changed. Charlton hasn't decided to open up his tactics. He hasn't decided to double down even more on them. And we get to the quarterfinals of Italia 90. And as you've suggested, it's a bit of a after the Lord Mayor show. Mm-hmm. Does the cumulative impact of Euro 88 and Italia 90 on broader Irish culture and in society in the 90s, in so much as it has an impact, is that dampened then if there's a Euro 88 and then a bit of a damper squib in Italia 90, and does it start to plateau and fall off earlier? And what does that do for...
I don't think it makes much difference, really, because I think that the World Cup is a bigger tournament. I mean, the Euros is now feels as big a tournament in the sense that it goes on forever. But it was like an eight team tournament that took 2 weeks to actually play. And so I still think that sort of Italia 90 would have been just bigger, because people had... It's a bit like when Fawlty Towers starts or something. This sounds like, but very often, particularly in the old days when things you had to watch television live to see a show. Yeah. Very often a show or Father Ted or something is often three or four episodes in before people cop on that this is a great show. Yeah. And so in some ways, even if we had actually qualified for the semi-final and got to the final, and else, I think people still wouldn't have had the time to cotton on. And then for Italia 90, there was all that stuff that was for a year in advance. There was sort of all kinds of campaigns, and there were big hammers and tricolors and all that sort of stuff that wasn't really there 2 years previously. So I think that sort of collective euphoria in Italia 90 would have been the same. Actually, I think it would have been much the same.
Do we definitely think Charlton would have stayed on if we got battered in the semi-finals rather than the great glorious epic failure in the group stage?
I don't think the fishing is as good on the Faroe Islands.
Or is there any chance he would have, if we'd done very well and you know, gone out in the semi-final on penalties or something, might he have gone fancy a crack back in an English club?
Well, it's possible that he would have been. I don't know. I feel a lot of the... Well, certainly he wouldn't have got the England job. You know, the English FA didn't like people like Charlton. They didn't like people like Brian Clough. I couldn't have seen him ever managing his own country. And I think he'd had a semi-successful career as a manager, but there was a sense that football had moved on. So I think that being manager of Ireland allowed him to still expound his views of how he wanted football played, with a freedom that, if he wanted to run for president, whoever was president at the time would have stepped aside. So I think if he'd gone back into, it was interesting, someone like John Giles was manager of West Bromwich Albion for a while and just stopped and just said, I can't deal with this club system, with a chairman and with all the shite that goes with that. And so I think that international football suited Charlton at the age he was at, in that it gave him great freedom. Nobody was going to question the way he wanted to play, and he didn't have to answer the managers, and he didn't have to deal with agents and with salaries and wages and all those negotiations that I suspect he wouldn't have had much time for.
So in a slightly maybe boring answer to a what if question, are we kind of the mind of, if Keith's goal doesn't go in, Ireland lose in the next round, but ultimately not much since then changes for Irish football or Irish society, actually?
I think there would have been, obviously there would have been incrementally far more sense of getting out of that group, because would have been a huge achievement, and it would have been a great sense of pride. Maybe there would have been more sense of expectation on the players, more pressure on the players to perform, because we still went to Italia 90 not expecting. I mean, just getting out of the group in Italia 90 was like a big thing and everything else. So it might have put more pressure on those players. It mightn't have been the same sort of thing, but it would have been lovely to have stuffed the Dutch. And there was actually, I was about to be engaged that year, and then my sons became very passionate about football. And then I actually sort of was with my son, who was around 12 years of age, when we played the Dutch in Lansdowne Road. And somehow or other, we Jason McAteer scored a goal when we were down to 10 men, and there were all kinds of, I think the Irish goalkeeper was sitting on one of the Dutch defenders, and so there was no way in the world we should have won that match. And when that ball went in, I let a scream out of me that was a primeval scream. It was a bit like the scream that Michael Corleone releases at the end of Godfather 3. and my son got quite scared. And I had to explain, no, so this goes back to Gelsenkirchen. So, like, revenge for Skipperine was nothing like revenge for Gelsenkirchen. So I think that made the time when we actually knocked the actual Dutch out of the World Cup so much sweeter by virtue of the fact that it was revenge for that match.
That's revenge served cold. What's that, like 14 years later or something?
You can walk a good scream up if you hold it inside you for long enough, you know?
You mentioned as well on that subject about holding up long grudges and letting them out. If the impact on Ireland then is that sort of incremental one, have you any view on if the Dutch go out and don't get, though, and you mentioned about the international relations with Germany, but if the Dutch go out in that tournament, I mean, what does it do to the Dutch morale, or have you any view on that, or were you solely focused on the green side of the terrace of the game?
Well, I was focused on the green side of the thing. I sort of felt that Dutch fans would have been there would have been 45 very unhappy Dutch, 1,000 very unhappy Dutch fans in that ground, many of whom didn't do embroidery at the weekends, was the impression that I actually got. And I think the Dutch team are an extraordinary self-destructive team. Who invariably have schisms and splits and everything else, and so that might well have hindered Dutch football. But Dutch football hasn't actually been that successful. You know, this thing of punching above your weight, as Ireland did. I mean, I think that Dutch football has managed to very spectacularly always punch below its weight ever since.
Yeah, because Dave, you and I were discussing. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, no, guys, I was going to say, like, it's really. I kind of find it really interesting. Again, yeah, apart from, I think when the main answer to what if Ireland had actually got through that game is that Dermot probably wouldn't be here on this call with us today. He would have been murdered back then. But it's Jurinus Mikkels was the manager there. You know, famous Dutch manager, managed them in 1974, managed the great Ajax team, managed the Barcelona early on when Cruyff was there. He leaves after the tournament when they win. But he comes back again in 1990 after Leo Beinhakker. I don't know how the hell to pronounce his Dutch name, but he comes back in. He managed them again in 90 to 92. He goes to Leverkusen in Germany, probably gets a good paid gig in German football after 88. I wonder if Holland do go out in the group stage and they do implode, they probably would turn on each other. But I wonder, would they have maybe stay together and maybe had that drive to go on and maybe not be as kind of passive as they ended up being in the World Cup in Italia 90, where they were a huge disappointment going out to West Germany in the second round after a dreadful one-all draw against us. And I think they drew with England and Egypt as well. Is that does he stay on? Does he not take that job at Leverkusen? And do they hold off their fight for just a bit longer, and do they actually play well with him as manager? Because they struggled. Jerry, you talked about their qualifying campaign, where they actually were in a group with West Germany.
They topped the group, but they can't score goals. Like in their first four games in the qualifiers for World Cup 90, they only scored 3 goals, and they're all in the 82nd, 87th, and the 87th minute.
Yeah, like, and so really their manager actually doesn't make it to the World Cup. Thijs Liebrechts, I think is his name. Again, I don't know how to pronounce that name. But he leads them through qualifying. They do qualify, but they're a bit brutal. He doesn't get to manage them in the World Cup. And then in the World Cup, they're a big disappointment. Is that classic Dutch drunk on success? And they just don't really pull it out. They don't get to have that release of beating West Germany in the semi-final where, again, Koeman still unapologetic to this day. Like you said, Germany wipes his arse with the jersey. And then you've got all that nonsense between Rudi Völler and Frank Rijkaard at the World Cup. Like, if they don't get that release in that tournament, are they actually good when they go to Italia 90? That's my question.
I think if this program is about what ifs, I think the most wonderful what if is, say, if Ireland had actually beaten them and the Dutch went mad and decided to offer Jack Charlton the job as Dutch manager. I think this would have been a pretty wonderful thing, because you actually, Dutch players are intellectuals by their nature, and they all think that they're managers. And they actually, and that's part of the system in Ajax and things, where you're brought up to actually question things, and you're brought up to actually, you know, be very, very independent and to really understand your football. I think it would have been just a wonderful thing of all these players with very strong opinions and prone to schisms and splits and sulks and temperamental outbursts being confronted by a Geordie who couldn't pronounce any of their names or remember any names. I just think that would have been the most wonderful what-if in football.
That would have been fantastic. Dave, this is becoming a bit of a trend on this, where we start bigging up Jack Charlton to move to all sorts of different jobs.
I think we've given him every job in football now. This is only the second one of these we've recorded. Like,
When I was doing research for this, I had this lovely notion that we'd have this huge butterfly effect of Mikkels leaves failing at Euro 88. They give the job to Johan Cruyff, who never goes to Barcelona. So we never get La Masia. We never get Tiki-Taka. We never get Guardiola. But unfortunately, Cruyff's already at Barcelona before the tournament. So that possible what-if has been shut down. But it would be very interesting to see what might have happened to the Dutch. Might they have got another tournament out of it? The other side of that coin then is the Germans. So if we do go on to play the Germans, they probably beat us. Instead of having this defeat to the Netherlands on home soil, finally in their home tournament, having come so close in World Cups, if they then get to the final of that tournament and win it, what might that do for West German football, particularly going into Italia 90? Do they have the reverse of what happened with the Dutch? Does Beckenbauer, having finally won a tournament, leave? And then, I suppose, and none of us have the answer to this, we're really into the realms of guesswork, whether Germany is in the midst of reunification around that time, it happens a year later or a year and a half later. But if Germany win that tournament, I mean, you were obviously in Germany at the time, what would it have meant for the Germans to have won that tournament?
Probably very little, in an odd way that they expect to win things. That is, and that's quite a good mentality. I remember that, in the World Cup 4 years later. More Irish fans. I mean, I think 3 or 4 times more Irish fans turned out for the defeated Irish team than the victorious German team. When in the homecoming and everything else. I mean, I think that there would have been an expectation that the Germans would have got the final and would have won, and it would have been the correct thing they would have felt. But I'm not sure that there would have been, orgies on the streets of Stuttgart, or any more orgies than you would have on your average Friday night.
I think that's possibly a fair comment to make. Like you say, the Germans expect to win tournaments. It's just... They don't get knocked back by losing all those finals in a row. They just keep going, and then eventually they win one. So, yeah, I think I think the Dutch might have been better in Italia 90 had they not won this tournament. That's my personal opinion, but I think Germans would still have been thereabouts.
The most wonderful culture clash of Euro 88 I remember was actually Italy played Denmark in a city with a big cathedral where you had to walk like 7,000 steps to go up to it. And we went there to have a look. And it was actually a wonderful culture clash because the Italians were in these, like, even like the poor Italians were in shoes that cost £3,000. You know what I mean? Like, and they were dressed impeccably, and they had all the attitude, you know, of cultured Millwall fans. You know what I mean? Like, they were actually sort of sharpness about them, you know, but they knew how to kick you in the balls, but they knew Dante as well. You know what I mean? And then you actually had the Danes, and all the Danes were wearing wigs and Viking horns, and they were singing the Hokey Cokey, and they were leaning on, and there were riot police around, and they were leaning on the riot policemen and hugging the riot policemen. And the German riot police were disgusted. They wanted to, like, you know, just beat fans up. And the Italian fans were disgusted as well, because they wouldn't have minded a row, you know, a good row. But the Danes were just like this cuddly, lovable, happy sort of people, you know. I remember saying, why couldn't we have actually met them? But actually, then they wound up winning the bloody thing.
By accident.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I suppose the only real other kind of thing to look at is the what might have happened to the Soviet Union. It was their second last tournament as a country. They qualified fairly handily for Italia 90 afterwards as well. They topped the group with France in it, I believe, to get to Italia 90. Do quite well. But do we think, if Ireland go through, Ireland play West Germany, possibly lose. It's West Germany against Soviet Union in the final. Do we give the Russians any chance of winning the thing, or do we think there's any, again, because the country is falling apart at that stage, is perestroika is happening, and the republics are starting to rebel, and the drunken man in the Russian parliament is starting to have his way. Do we think that they might have done anything special? It might have had any effect on the society if they might have actually won that tournament?
Well, it's possible, of course, that if they'd beaten Ireland, there would have been such a rush of patriotism that the whole country would have reunited and the USSR would still exist. And when those poor astronauts came back from space, they would have come back to the same country that they took off from. But this is a question outside my remit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's outside of probably all of our remits.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. I think they just, the Soviets were always just good. Not quite on the verge of great, but always just good, solid. They had that Dynamo Kiev team that were doing brilliant in the mid-80s and the late 80s, won a couple of European trophies and stuff. But probably still would have lost to West Germany in the final, still would have qualified quite handily for Italia 90, and still would have gone out in the second round.
Yeah, I think Soviet football in Eastern Europe, as well, East European Europe, behind the Iron Curtain as it was also run on really strange lines. That the secret police had their team, the army had their team, you actually sort of had a lot of state control, you had a lot of great players who weren't able to fulfill their commercial potential in the sense of weren't able to go abroad and make money playing for Barcelona and playing for all these things. So you actually had a lot of internal behind the scenes dissatisfaction. So you just wonder how much that played into the success or otherwise of people who were playing for a country that they may not have necessarily felt a part of.
Yeah, very true, very true. But it kind of what also happened when the Soviet Union broke up. Sorry, Maria, going a little bit off point here, but was when all of that state and army and secret police money that was propping up these teams, particularly in the Soviet Union, when that ran out, all of the players ran for the West as quickly as they could, and all these teams kind of, they just haven't been able to compete financially ever since. So it's kind of a shame. I used to love watching those old early European Cup days when I was young, watching an English team go behind the Iron Curtain and play an away game against Dynamo Tbilisi or Dynamo Kiev or someone like that. It was always really fun. I miss those days. I'm not yearning for the return of the Soviet Union, but in football sense, it was always fun.
I do remember Liverpool playing Red Star Belgrade, and just, it was so fascinating to watch because it was a whole clash of two different cultures. Whereas there's actually very, whereas now there's just this merging, everything has merged together. I remember being in the Belfield Bowl, watch UCD, who qualified for Europe for the only time in their life, I think, on the fair play rule, because they haven't picked up any bookings, playing at a team from Luxembourg. But it was interesting how, like, almost none of the team were actually from Luxembourg. They were all from, just all, I don't mean mercenaries in a bad way, in a way that Bingham used in a very bad way. There were people, they were a bit like the Preston Dundalk team. They were just journeymen, footballers, finding their level. So much of football all over the world is like that now. And you don't, when an English team or a French team draw a team from wherever, there isn't that great excitement of seeing the new. The shock of the new isn't there in football anymore, really, you know?
Look, I suppose to wrap up then, we've looked at this, what on the face of it was a tantalizing what if, but between us, we've kind of decided that had the goal not gone in and Ireland had gone through, they'd have lost in the semi-final and not a huge amount would have changed in the intervening time. The West Germans probably would have gone on to win the tournament. They would have expected to, and not a huge amount might have changed. The Dutch would have gone out and would probably have been better in Italia 90, but who knows? And had the Soviet Union won it, there was an outside chance it might have helped to revive patriotism for the Soviet Union. So a tantalizing what if, but on the face of it, actually, maybe not that different to what actually happened.
Yeah. So yeah, the answer, what if? What would have changed?
The answer, great. Well, if, lovely talking to you two lads, is what if sense prevailed and there were 8-team tournaments again? And wouldn't they be great to watch?
Here, here! I couldn't agree more. Although we'd never qualify again, but
no, we wouldn't. No.
We're struggling to qualify for the 2014 ones anyway, so we may as well have a good tournament when we're not there.
That was a pleasure reminiscing with you lads and talking shout for Ireland.
Thanks a million, Dermot, for joining us, sharing your recollections of before and during the tournament and discussing with us what we think might have happened. And thank you for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
We'd love to hear from you on how you think things might have played out, or if you've any ideas for other interesting football what-ifs. You can get in touch with us on Twitter or Instagram at whatiffootypod, or by email at outsidethebox@gmail.com. We hope you tune in again next time. Please tell your friends if you liked the show, and even if you didn't, tell them you did. I've been Dave Fleming.
And I've been Jared O'Shea. This has been Outside the Box. Euro 88 might have ended in heartbreak in Gelsenkirchen, but for Irish supporters, you'll always have Stuttgart. Goodbye.
Thank you very much, everybody.